each of the various branches of the armed services, but each of these subunits also had administrative commanders within their own branch of service. The task force commander, for example, did not oversee the selection of personnel, training, or maintenance of the Ranger Regiment. That was the regimental commander's job, and in executing it, he was answerable up a distinctly different chain of command, to Army Special Operations Command and the Department of the Army. It is an awkward system. I would joke that commanding the task force is a bit like being a Formula One driver. You get to drive an incredible car, but you don't own it. And you don't pay for the repairs when you break something. Naturally, there is a bit of tension between the car's owners and the man driving it through a war zone every day. Despite the difficulties, we placed SEALs alongside Army Special Forces, alongside Army Rangers, alongside intelligence analysts whose prior exposure to our operators had been limited to complaints about the speed and quality of the analyses they provided. Individual and organizational arrogance manifested itself in subtle ways as people tried to assert or maintain their preeminence. Ultimately, however, the press of the fight demanded expedience, and expedience demanded a meritocracy. If an individual or unit produced good intelligence, reliable coordination, or accurate and timely warnings, they rose in relevance and respect. Legacy accomplishments or bluster might work for a while, but eventually people either produced or faded in importance. No one wanted to hear what you'd done in the last war. However dysfunctional the internal competition within our command, it was dwarfed by that between our organization and the CIA, NSA, FBI, and other external agencies. Much as von Braun found with NASA contractors, we realized that no group could be useful if it did not understand the full context. We could not simply ship our intelligence requirements out to these agencies and expect them to realize all the intricacies of what we wanted and needed. They had to sit with us to understand exactly what was happening on the ground. We hoped that eventually they would reciprocate by giving us similar insights into how the war looked from their offices. When filled, the SAR felt cramped and occasionally very loud. Many of the people sent to work with us found the environment distracting or were uncomfortable in the participatory atmosphere. For bureaucrats who had built careers on discretion and never putting a toe out of line by oversharing, our way of working was anathema. One partner agency offered the same response every day for the first year of our experiment. Nothing new to report on our end. Just as our individual teams benefited from a shared sense of purpose that extended from the tactical situation on the ground to larger strategic goals, the elements of task force would need to share both an up-to-the-minute awareness of the battlefield and a belief that we were all fighting the same war, based on the same principles and with the same objectives. We hoped to lay the foundations for both, as NASA had done, by pressing holistic awareness and integration throughout the organization as a whole. If everyone had the same playbook, maybe we would get better at the game. The critical first step was to share our own information widely and be generous with our own people and resources. From there, we hoped that the human relationships we built through that generosity would carry the day. Information sharing had to include every part of the force. As soon as our operators completed a raid, we would rush the evidence to the nearest outstation, photograph every scrap, and use our new bandwidth to feed the data to imagery analysts, linguists, and other subject matter experts. It was choppy and unpolished, but instantaneous. No more trash bags and post-it notes piling up in a closet. Moreover, as with our CCs and our speakerphone, we distributed our intelligence and analysis widely, without preconditions. This struck many as naive. But as the old adage goes, knowledge is power, and we were throwing that power to the wind. Our thinking was that the value of this information and the power that came with it were greater the more it was shared. Success. By 2005, at least one of our hypotheses had been confirmed. Because the intelligence agencies got faster and more robust intelligence from the task force than from any other source, they dramatically increased their participation. Our process began to develop its own gravitational pull as more and more groups recognized what the speed and transparency we had put in place could offer. Our forces were in daily contact with Al-Qaeda, the nation's highest counterterrorism priority, and we were offering to share whatever we were learning. Many of the joint interagency task forces, JATIFs, we had formed in Iraq and Afghanistan, grew as partner agencies began deploying more young analysts to serve downrange and gain access to the intelligence our operators and sources were producing. A Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, analyst could walk from the JATIF over to our temporary screening facility where we housed Al-Qaeda detainees and contribute questions to or observe the interviews of a detainee. The analyst could write a first-hand report for his headquarters with the most current information from the counterterrorism battlefield. That was good for the analyst and good for the analyst's organization. It might also generate a response from the analyst's parent organization that could be valuable to us the next day, or be connected to another report from somewhere else in the world. One individual, properly empowered, became a conduit to a larger network that could contribute back into our process. We made sure that our operators interacted with the analysts. One Army Special Forces squadron commander mandated that his operators sit with intel analysts, taking notes on how they worked, how they thought, and what kinds of information they found most useful. As he put it, to win, all of us would need to be knee-deep in the fight all of the time. In time, people came to appreciate the value of systemic understanding. O&I attendance grew as the quality of the information and interaction grew. Eventually, we had 7,000 people attending almost daily for up to 2 hours. To some management theorists, that sounds like a nightmare of inefficiency, but the information that was shared in the O&I was so rich, so timely, and so pertinent to the fight, no one wanted to miss it. The O&I also became one of the best leadership tools in my arsenal. Our organization was globally dispersed and included thousands of individuals from organizations not directly under the control of the task force. The O&I could not replace a hand on a shoulder, but video could convey a lot of meaning and motivation. Our leadership learned, over time, to use this forum not as a stereotypical military briefing where junior personnel give nicely rehearsed updates and hope for no questions. Instead, it was an interactive discussion. If an individual had a 4-minute slot, the update portion would be covered in the first 60 seconds, and the remainder of the time would be filled with open-ended conversation between the briefer and senior leadership, and potentially anyone else on the network if they saw a critical point to be made. Instead of black and white lines of questioning, how many X, our dialogue became interactive and broad. Why are you thinking X? The responses to this type of interaction created new insights, deepened the group's understanding of a complex issue, and highlighted the deep levels of understanding of our personnel around the globe. Most important, it allowed all members of the organization to see problems being solved in real time and to understand the perspective of the senior leadership team. This gave them the skills and confidence to solve their own similar problems without the need for further guidance or clarification. By having thousands of personnel listen to these daily interactions, we saved an incalculable amount of time that was no longer needed to seek clarification or permission. The fusion of operations and intelligence, O and I, was the essence of the meeting. An imagery analyst could report on recent activity at a location of interest during the meeting, say, at 5 p.m. Iraqi time, and that house could be raided by rangers within hours. At the next day's O&I, another analyst could then discuss the chemical makeup of the explosives found in the house's car bomb workshop. The initial imagery analyst would get the visceral satisfaction that her work had saved lives and that her continued effort was impacting operations directly, not just generating a paper storm in D.C. Our organization was not just getting smarter or doing more in isolation. Instead, it was acting smarter and learning constantly, simultaneously. The best moments in the O and I were when the briefing touched off a debate between different agencies or teams or departments. Perhaps two analytical silos had reached drastically different conclusions based on the same evidence, and we needed to reconcile them and understand why. Perhaps a team in Mosul had seen a tactic or a group of individuals eerily reminiscent of what a team in Tikrit had seen last week. The meetings allowed critical information to reach the right ears and eyes. The risk, of course, was that it might reach the wrong ears and eyes as well. The question was how that potential risk stacked up against the benefits. What about WikiLeaks? On January 5, 2010, a 22-year-old Army specialist walked out of a secure, or supposedly secure, room on Forward Operating Base Hammer, 40 miles east of Baghdad, with nearly 400,000 highly classified military reports from the war in Iraq, all saved on CDs he had marked Lady Gaga. 3 days later, he popped the CDs into his work computer and downloaded 91,000 reports on Afghanistan. Over the next several months, he repeated the same stunt, eventually gathering 250,000 classified State Department cables, which he passed on to WikiLeaks. By November, all had been released on the Internet to the global public. The U.S. government went into convulsions. "This disclosure is not just an attack on America's foreign policy interests," said Secretary of State Hillary Clinton the day after the State Department cables leaked. "It is an attack on the international community." Never before in U.S. history had so much classified material been compromised in one blow. Since then, several similar incidents have unfolded, most notably the even bigger leak perpetrated by contractor Edward Snowden. An investigation identified the soldier, who by then had been demoted to private first class, as Bradley Manning. Upon arrest, Manning was further demoted to private and has since changed her name to Chelsea. A Fox News op-ed asked with outrage how all this leaked information was the work of a single 22-year-old enlisted man in the Army. The author was incredulous. How could one individual gain such access to all that classified material? Clearly, we have grossly under-prioritized information security. Since the 9/11 Commission report famously concluded that the U.S. intelligence community had all the pieces of the puzzle, but had failed to put them together and protect the country, the national security community has seen a gradual but undeniable paradigm shift toward greater information sharing. 10 years after September 11th, fact finders for the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs reported, The attacks on 9/11 showed all of us that the Cold War need-to-know system for managing classified and sensitive information drove a culture of information security that resulted in countless stovepipes and secretive pockets of the nation's most valuable information. At the same time, the national security apparatus has ballooned in size. As of this writing, 854,000 people hold clearance at the top secret level, and a third of them are private contractors. The result is that more secret information is more easily accessible by more people than has ever been the case. Partly as a result of those changes, a very young soldier with a history of depression and erratic behavior was given access to a trove of secret documents. Stealing and disseminating those documents was as easy as using some elementary codework and a few compact disks. Should better defenses have been in place to prevent this information from being copied by Manning? Certainly. Should blank CDs be disallowed in a secure compartmentalized information facility? Obviously. Should superiors have intervened and prevented Private Manning from deploying to Iraq based on a history of behavioral issues in the Army? Without a doubt. Did Private Manning put lives at risk? Yes. But was it a mistake to design a system that gave privates and specialists access to extensive and valuable data? Absolutely not. Massive leaks are not an inevitable consequence of the current level of information sharing. But even if they were, the benefits vastly outweigh the potential costs. The sharing of information within the U.S. intelligence community since 9/11 has saved many lives and done far more good than the damage from incidents like the Manning and Snowden leaks has done harm. We should not let the fact that the benefits are usually invisible, whereas the leaks make front-page news, blind our assessment. Our task force never experienced any serious leaks, but we knowingly ran that risk every time we held our O&I. Our experience was that shared information saved lives on an untold scale. Brains in a footlocker benefit no one, and taking them out was a critical step. However, achieving team-like levels of shared consciousness would take more than just sharing information.
Recap. Shared consciousness in an organization is either hindered or helped by physical spaces and established processes. Often, efforts to facilitate Taylor-inspired efficiencies have produced barriers to information sharing and the kind of systemic understanding we needed to pervade our task force. Creating transparency and information sharing at the scale we needed required not only a redesign of our physical plant, but also a rethinking of almost every procedure in our organizational culture. The daily O&I briefing lay at the core of our transformation. This pumped information about the entire scope of our operations out to all members of the task force and partner agencies, and also offered everyone the chance to contribute.
Chapter 9. Beating the Prisoner's Dilemma. In one of the most memorable scenes from Ron Howard's 2001 movie, A Beautiful Mind, the protagonist, mathematician John Nash, played by Russell Crowe, is sitting with three colleagues in a Princeton bar when four women walk through the door. One of them, referred to only as the blonde, is breathtakingly beautiful. One sultry glance from her over to the mathematician's table, and the men are convinced that she is interested. But who is to be the lucky man? Jokingly, one asks, "Shall we say swords, gentlemen? Pistols at dawn?" Another says, "Every man for himself, gentlemen." Another provides academic context for their face-off, saying, "Recall the lessons of Adam Smith, the father of modern economics, to which the group replies together, "In competition, individual ambition serves the common good." But Nash, slash Crow, shuffling the stack of papers he brought with him to their night out, doesn't join in. Instead, he adopts the far-off look that moviegoers know signals revelatory contemplation and, as ethereal piano twiddling grows louder in the background, he says quietly, "Adam Smith needs revision." "If we all go for the blonde," he explains, "none will get her. Determined to undermine one another, they will, driven by competition, destroy one another's chances." Then, he says, "we will go for her friends. But scorned by being second choice, they will all give the men the cold shoulder." "What if no one goes for the blonde?" he suggests. "If the four men each strike up conversation with one of her four friends, we don't get in each other's way, and we don't insult the other girls." With a faint grin, he says, "it's the only way we win." Then runs out of the bar to spend the night alone recording his epiphany. This fictionalized episode provides a good introduction to one of the major ideas of game theory. While Adam Smith has led us to believe that, as Movie Nash summarizes it, the best result comes from everyone in the group doing what's best for himself, Movie Nash adds that there are times when the best result would come from everyone in the group doing what's best for themselves and the group. This basic tenet of game theory is also illustrated by the prisoner's dilemma. In this famous thought experiment, two criminals, co-conspirators, are arrested. They are taken to separate cells and interrogated. Both are offered the same deal. If you stay silent, you'll be sentenced to 1 year. If you rat on your partner, you'll go free. But if your partner rats on you, you'll serve 2 years. From a competitive, personal interest perspective, both prisoners are incentivized to rat. However, if both prisoners rat, then they both end up with a worse deal, serving 2 years, than they would have had they cooperated, each serving 1 year. The prisoner's dilemma has interesting management implications. First, it suggests that there are circumstances in which cooperation is better than competition. This may seem obvious, but many managers assume that the healthy competitiveness between companies, the lifeblood of the free market, should be echoed within companies. Some of the 20th century's most fabled executives extolled this competitive spirit, purposefully pitting individual workers and departments against one another. Jack Welch introduced the stack ranking system, where employees constantly saw themselves assessed relative to others, an approach that became popular with leaders in other industries. Encouragement to collaborate tends to be more of a bumper sticker slogan than an actual managerial practice. In an interdependent environment, however, collaboration may be necessary to survival. We were a real-life prisoner's dilemma. Each agency feared that sharing intelligence would work against its own interests. Competition between agencies made them reluctant to provide information. What if a partner agency didn't reciprocate? If each agency would cooperate, we would have the best possible outcome. But we could achieve that outcome only if we overcame the dilemma. Incentivizing collaboration, however, is easier said than done. For starters, both prisoners must be shown the entire decision-making system, not just their own choices. If shown only his own fate, each prisoner will choose to betray the other. It is only when they are shown the decision-making stakes of the accomplice that they understand the consequences. This was what we were trying to achieve with the participatory transparency of our physical plant and forums, like the O and I. There is something else at play as well. While systemic understanding gives each prisoner an intellectual reason to understand why cooperation would be beneficial, It does not provide an assurance that his or her accomplice will follow through. After all, each individual's dominant strategy is betrayal. Even with holistic awareness, the prisoners still have to take a leap of faith. We needed true, not theoretical, collaboration, transparency, and trust. Putting everyone in the same room was a start. But if we wanted instinctive, second-nature, team-like trust, we would have to go much deeper. The stronger the ties between our teams, as with the prisoners, the higher the likelihood we would achieve the level of cooperation we needed. As a side note, the lesson of separating prisoners is one that we also learned quite literally. When we held detainees, we found that when they were kept in the same room, they never cracked. When they were separated, it became much easier to persuade them to provide information. When we first began nurturing shared consciousness, we did not fully appreciate the strength of the cultural barriers we were trying to overcome. If our partner organizations came to the table at all, they came with decades-long histories and a particular telescope for viewing the problem. What happened outside that tube of vision was irrelevant. Intelligence agencies wanted to build networks of understanding ground truth through human sources or information or technical collection means. Diplomatic agencies wanted to create long-term institutions and stability. Our counterterrorism forces wanted to solve the real-time problems they saw on the battlefield night after night. Each of these perspectives had value, but none could succeed in isolation. Showing them abstractly was not enough. In order to achieve cross-functionality, our bonds with our partner organizations had to become as strong as those between the individuals on our operational teams. Too often we viewed our partners solely in terms of what we could get and give. We began to make progress when we started looking at these relationships as just that. Relationships. Parts of a network, not cogs in a machine with outputs and inputs. The kinds of relationships we needed have roots that go deeper than simply bartering. If we could develop that kind of understanding between partners, then one day down the line, in a particularly urgent moment, one side might be able to urge the other, "Trust me here," and have it work out. Walk a mile in an analyst's shoes. One of our most controversial moves was our embedding program, an exchange system we began in late 2003 in which we would take an individual from one team, say, an Army Special Forces operator, and assign him to a different part of our force for 6 months, a team of SEALs, for example, or a group of analysts. Our hope was that, by allowing our operators to see how the war looked from inside other groups, and by building personal relationships, we could build between teams some of the fluency that traditionally exists within teams. Predictably, initial resistance was intense. "Our teams train in entirely different ways," I was informed. I was told that I needed to understand that the tight bonds inside assault teams came from working with trusted comrades over years. To insert an outsider is an unwise and unfair risk to operators already performing the most difficult of missions. Simply put, it was anathema to the entire history and tradition of special operations selection, training, and war fighting. But I, and some other leaders, were convinced that we would have to bring together the different elite forces across the task force to an extent never before required or envisioned. This fight could not be won by anything but a tightly connected team. As we implemented these exchanges, what we saw would likely have been predicted by a social scientist. Although it was a forced initiative, once the mandate was in place, elite units were naturally incentivized to send their best operators and leaders. These individuals, would be representing their organization, so unit pride would drive them to select the best examples from an already highly selective sample set. Many of these top-of-the-pack personalities were also the types that had a natural ability to connect with others, especially in an environment where leadership and one's capability as an operator were a critical measuring stick among peers. For example, we would require that an Army Special Forces operator embed with a SEAL team. The Special Forces are characterized by exceptional discipline at the individual level, while SEALs pride themselves on creative thinking at the operator level and a strong sense of individuality. The points of tension were predictable, but the Special Forces operator would soon realize the cultural norms of the SEALs and, while remaining true to his home unit's ethos, find a way to work effectively within the new structure. Over time, he would also begin to see some of the positives of the alternative approach, ultimately learning from SEAL culture and finding strengths that he could bring back to his team. The SEALs, meanwhile, would see in the Army operator the strengths of the culture that he came from, realizing that the individuality promoted there clearly comes with strengths that they could learn from. As an added bonus, each unit wouldn't see the exchanged operator as a one-off example. Rather, they would see their newfound friend as representative of the entire unit from which he came, and their feelings of trust and understanding would expand to the other unit, even if they'd only really gotten to know a single operator. This connective tissue grew stronger. When these operators returned to their home unit, their positive comments on the rival unit would spread, deepening the ties between teams. Slowly, we grew the bonds of trust needed for us to overcome our prisoner's dilemma. We also expanded and refined our system of sending liaison officers to our partner organizations. Liaisons are institutionalized ambassadors who serve to connect organizations. Our task force would send a liaison to, say, the CIA, and they would send a liaison to us. Traditionally, this was a duty assigned to someone on their final tour before retirement, or as a way to shuffle someone away from a squadron where they were not fitting in. Their duties were unenvied, and they were generally seen as a spy by the gaining organization, someone who was there simply to sit through meetings and report back to their home organization. They brought very little to the plate and were rarely trusted. However, as interfaces became increasingly important, we realized the potential for bolstering our relationships with our partner agencies by way of a strong linchpin liaison officer, LNO. As it turned out, some of our best LNOs were also some of our best leaders on the battlefield. We started taking world-class commandos, men who could snipe, fast rope, and skydive, and we placed them, attired in civilian suits, in embassies thousands of miles from the fight because we knew we needed a great relationship with the ambassador and the other interagency leadership posted there. Everyone hated removing some of our best operators from the battlefield, but we reaped enormous benefits. Our goal was twofold. First, we wanted to get a better sense of how the war looked from our partners' perspectives to enhance our understanding of the fight. We saw one piece of AQI up close and daily, but we knew that they were part of a larger, global system of finance, weapons, and ideology about which other people knew much more than we did. Second, we hoped that if the liaisons we sent contributed real value to our partners' operations, it would lay a foundation for the trusting relationships we needed to develop between the nodes of our network. We became LNO fanatics. I would spend hours with my commanders hand-selecting the best personalities and skill sets for different jobs. The person we sent to liaise with the embassy in Amman needed to be one thing. The one sent to work with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, another. We knew we always needed a superstar in certain key positions, such as our LNO to the CIA, and I would insist that these key locations be manned by someone who had proven effective elsewhere. If we looked at our global enterprise as an organism, with the heart in the middle of the combat zone, these LNOs were our nerve endings. When asking for LNO nominations to fill critical positions, we used two criteria. One, if it doesn't pain you to give the person up, pick someone else. Two, if it's not someone whose voice you'll recognize when they call you at home at 2 a.m., pick someone else. Previously, we might have made these decisions based on rank, position, or where people wanted to go in their careers. But to get this right, personal qualities trumped everything else. These were people who needed to enter an unknown and sometimes hostile bureaucratic environment, then build trust-based relationships with the leadership there. A very difficult proposition. Once we had LNOs in place, they couldn't fall victim to the out-of-sight, out-of-mind syndrome, nor could they be viewed as simply staff augmentation to the organization we'd sent them to. Instead, we considered them precious assets, but knew they could be that only if we had the right personalities empowered with the right support from us. Early on, we learned that to be effective where we sent them, our LNOs needed to have access to senior leaders in that organization and to be trusted. That didn't come easily. Chicken sandwiches and trash. Lieutenant Commander Conway's reception was chilly. I'd secured grudging permission from the country team in the U.S. Embassy in an unstable Middle Eastern country to place a single task force liaison with them to help coordinate the wider effort against Al-Qaeda. But there were clear, understandable reservations when the battle-hardened SEAL officer appeared. Worries ranged from compromise of sensitive intelligence to concerns over task force combat forces appearing on the scene. Some were as mundane as the competition for physical space in the embassy, others more deeply rooted in the wide gulf between organizational cultures. Most qualms were as unfounded as they were natural, but all were real obstacles. We'd chosen Conway carefully, Conway being a pseudonym. He was a walking mass of extroverted energy, habitually upbeat and helpful. In his previous tour, he'd worn body armor and night vision goggles to go toe-to-toe with Al-Qaeda fighters in Anbar province. But his new mission required him to be accepted by his new colleagues. Where Iraq had forced Conway to risk his life, now he decided he had to subordinate his ego. At his new post, he was initially granted no access to intelligence and given nothing to do. So, Conway volunteered to take out the trash. Each afternoon, he went office to office, gathering refuse and carrying it to the dumpster. When he found out that one embassy colleague loved Chick-fil-A sandwiches, Conway arranged for the next task force delivery to include several in its contents. A man the U.S. government had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to train as a SEAL was, for 3 months, a glorified garbage man and fast food delivery boy. But when the situation heated up in the country's capital and the ambassador came to our LNO and asked whether he knew anything about force protection and dealing with the growing Al-Qaeda threat, our man was exactly where he needed to be. "I do," he said. "That's what I'm trained in. And I can do you one better. Let me make a call." Soon the entire weight of the task force enterprise was at the disposal of the interagency team at the embassy. Our LNO was there to serve the collective mission, from trash to terrorism. The task force's relationship with that country grew tighter nearly instantaneously. A new node in our network came online and began to thrive. We found that it was essential that we make our LNO's key players at their host agencies. To some degree, like Conway, our men and women could accomplish much through force of personality and talent, but they also needed institutional support from the task force. I thought of my LNOs as old-school deep-sea divers, connected to the surface by an oxygen hose. Their effectiveness depended on our ability to pump resources and information to them, making them effective and desirable to their hosts. Nothing was more highly valued by many of our partners than insights into the shadowy counter-terrorist fight we were waging. So we armed our LNOs with a constant stream of intelligence and empowered them to share it as they felt appropriate. Information sharing was key, because ultimately, that was what we might one day turn around and request from the host agency in return. Ideally, an LNO would develop such a fantastic relationship with the NSA or National Geospatial Agency, NGA, for example, that when we really needed sensitive signals or imagery intelligence on a target urgently, it would come quickly, fully, and without any bureaucratic friction, on a phone call. As partner organizations came to appreciate our LNOs, they reciprocated by sending their own LNOs to us. The talent pool available to us steadily increased as our partners came to realize that the better their LNO, the more they could leverage the task force to help with their hardest missions. The empty seats around our SAR filled up. The JATF swelled with analysts sent from across the United States. Just as BUDS increases the horizontal bonds between aspiring SEALs, we found that this approach to collaboration was strengthening the ties not only among the task force's internal teams, but also between the task force and the partner agencies with whom we would have to cooperate in order to win the fight. As the liaising ramped up, organizations signaled their enthusiasm about our task force by the quality of people that they sent us. Receiving a talentless functionary frequently meant that his home agency was planning to stonewall. A superstar showed they were eager to engage. Steadily, in large part as a result of internal embedding and LNOs, and complemented by the growing O&I, we began to overcome internal competition and barriers to cooperation. Bonds of trust began to form. People from different tribes began to see increasingly familiar faces. Even strangers were now, by extension, part of a familiar and trusted unit entity, and received the benefit of the doubt. Being part of the network became an important form of capital. Most important, it was not a zero-sum game. The more you put into the system, the more it could serve you. Nowhere was the elimination of territorialism clearer than in the exchange of our coveted air assets. ISR. Under a pitch black sky, 30 operators jogged toward idling helicopters. Rotor blades whirled, kicking hot desert air across the airfield runway. 10 minutes earlier, this team had received its final briefing on the night's mission. They would be in flight for 35 minutes and then patrol for nearly an hour before hitting the target. They were out to capture a mid-level AQI operative. The target, they believed, had intelligence that would help them get one step closer to an upper echelon enemy leader in the region. It would not be the most incredible mission of any of their careers, but it was the night's work, and an important step in their efforts to understand and dismantle the network. The operators took their seats, and officers took final headcounts. The assault commander plugged into the helicopter radio. With the flip of a switch, he could speak with his team on the helicopters, the pilots up front, or his leadership at headquarters. He could also monitor communications between his headquarters and other assault elements around the country. His pilots were going through final checks when he heard the call. Lima 2-1, this is Lima 0-3. His senior officer, who sat 500 yards from the helicopters in their operations center, was making contact. Perhaps, he hoped, it was a positive update from the target site, which was currently being monitored by ISR, Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance, feed into the operations center. Go for 2-1, he replied. We just got word, 2-1, that ISR is being pulled for a priority target in Baghdad. That puts us below minimum requirements. We need to stand down. The commander felt frustrated. His pilot, who also heard the call, looked over his shoulder and made eye contact with the assault team leader. The pilot slashed his hand across his throat to confirm what he'd just heard. The assault team leader nodded, then cued his radio. Roger, 0-3. Shutting it down. The pilot killed the rotors. We lost our ISR, gents. We're standing down. In the dark, he could see helmets being removed and heads shaking. It was the second night in a row that they had lost their assets. To a degree never before seen in warfare, ISR assets like Predator unmanned aerial vehicles or a small prop-driven manned aircraft like the Beechcraft King Air we'd gutted and outfitted with surveillance equipment became coin of the realm in our fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. ISR dramatically expanded our ability to gather intelligence on targets and develop new ones. In the conduct of raids, the real-time FMV, full-motion video coverage, that was piped to multiple locations on the ground, allowed commanders to pare assault forces to a minimum by providing security from enemy reinforcements that had before required us to place a cordon of troops around the target site. Without ISR, a raid might require an additional platoon or more of troops, more helicopters, and other support. Simply put, the more ISR a unit had access to, the more operations it could execute. Competition for ISR within our task force was intense. Early in the war, one of the most time-consuming parts of senior leadership's job was determining where to deploy our limited assets. When a ground commander was forced to hand over an ISR asset, it could cause internal convulsions in the task force and potentially serious loss of morale for the affected unit. The way our operators experienced it on the ground, one moment they had a helicopter or a Predator, the next moment it was gone. From their vantage point, someone else had taken it. It was a zero-sum game. All they knew concretely was that they couldn't do their mission. When they understood the whole picture, they began to trust their colleagues. Much like the prisoners deciding whether or not to rat, our commander's responsiveness to such demands grew as they came to understand the greater environment in which the decision had been made, and the people receiving what had been taken away. Previously, the world outside of a commander's domain looked like a black box. Once an asset left, it was just gone. Once they could see why and how their assets were being used, however, and once they knew and respected the other individuals handling these tools, things changed. Before, these decisions took place behind closed doors. Now, the resourcing conversations sometimes occurred right in front of them during an O&I. When we started constantly talking at lower levels of the organization, explains an enlisted SEAL who worked with the task force in Iraq. We could basically see where the fight was hot, where it wasn't, and where people needed ISR the most. Plus, we could see that it was actually to our benefit sometimes to surrender that asset. With that awareness came a faith that when theirs was the priority mission, they would get what they needed when they needed it. Holistic understanding of the enterprise now permeated the ranks. As person-to-person relationships across the enterprise deepened, unit commanders gave away prized assets, often to the initial surprise and frustration of those below them, because they trusted that the asset would be used in a context even more critical than their current situation. Moreover, they began to see the favor being repaid in kind. This fostered trust in the other unit among even the most skeptical, hardened, competitive operators. Suddenly, we were overcoming our prisoner's dilemma. We had worked out our solutions to the task force's prisoner's dilemma by trial and error. But we later learned that game theory scholars shared our conclusions. In 1980, Robert Axelrod, a professor of political science at the University of Michigan, solicited programs for an iterative computer prisoner's dilemma tournament. The 14 entries in the original first round, submitted by leading game theorists across a spectrum of disciplines, including economics, psychology, mathematics, and political science, varied greatly in initial strategy and complexity of coding. However, the winning strategy contained just 4 lines of code. Submitted by University of Toronto Professor Anatole Rapoport, the program was called Tit for Tat. The strategy always began with cooperating, and then simply did what the other player did on the previous move, cooperating if the other cooperated, defecting if the other defected. It did not hold a grudge. If its opponent began to cooperate again after defecting, tit for tat would also return to cooperation. A second round of the tournament was held, and many more entries were submitted. Again, Rapoport's simple strategy won out. The program succeeded because it defaulted to trusting cooperative behavior and punished the other player for selfish behavior. However, as one peace and conflict studies expert has since noted, the punishment lasted only as long as the selfish behavior lasted. This proved to be an exceptionally effective sanction, quickly showing the other side the advantages of cooperating. Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning cognitive scientist, believes that the human mind has 2 different decision-making tracks. System 1 operates automatically and quickly, while System 2 is deliberate and effortful. We tend to use System 1 frequently and reflexively, for instance, gauging the emotions on someone's face, and apply System 2 when weighing difficult decisions or attempting complex calculations. What we saw in the task force was that while cooperation began as a conscious System 2 decision, they'll help me later if I help them now, cooperation is in my interest, a track record of productive collaborations led to reflexive System 1 cooperation. In other words, real trust. Furthermore, this trust had a viral effect. Once it passed a certain threshold, it became the norm. One of the best examples of this symbiosis was our newfound ability to hit follow-on targets. Follow-on targets. AQI was organized as pockets of fighters spread geographically around the country. Key leadership moved constantly, bouncing between geographic hubs to share information and guidance with their network of fighters. If Al-Qaeda was an organism, the hubs of fighters were the muscle, while the mobile leaders were the oxygen, providing energy for the muscles and the roads of Iraq with a circulatory system through which this oxygen could flow. Movement over long distances was done during the daylight hours, since AQI knew that our night vision and overnight reconnaissance assets gave us an advantage over them in the dark. If we were to disrupt their network, we not only needed to own the night, we had to disrupt the oxygen flow during the day. Daytime interdiction of AQI leadership was a simple and elegant concept, born on a whiteboard during a discussion between operators and intelligence officers. If life worked like the movies, the force would have launched an operation immediately. But on a real battlefield, such concepts are followed by a litany of logistical queries. How would we follow the vehicle in heavy traffic? How would we stop a vehicle? Could our helicopters get from our compounds to the vehicle's location fast enough? As operators approached the location, how could they be sure they were moving toward the correct car? The list went on. Success would require perfect choreography between our best ground operators, our helicopter pilots, our operational headquarters, and our overhead intelligence collection platforms, as well as fluid, iterative adaptation across our force. A typical cycle ran like this. After we hit a target in the middle of the night, the assault element would return to base, debrief the mission, and ensure that intelligence analysts were tracking any key information they'd learned on the target. The operators would grab a hot meal before heading to bed just after sunrise. At this point, their work for the night is done. Meanwhile, the daylight hour intelligence teams continue to monitor the target. The interaction between these operators and analysts, once uncomfortable and mechanical, is now fluid and natural. They trust one another and knew that cooperation is in their own interests, as well as for the greater good. On one of our raids, the previous night's target building had been a safe house for a group of fighters. Just before noon, while our operators from the night prior are sleeping, overhead reconnaissance platforms identify a vehicle pulling up to the compound, the site of the gunfight a few hours ago. A blurry black and white video feed grabs the attention of the daylight intelligence team. They watch as the driver and two others park outside and walk into the courtyard, clearly unaware of the previous night's activities. All eyes focus on the three fuzzy figures on the large screens at the front of their operations center. The figures slow as they enter the courtyard, sensing that something isn't right. They stop and look around, probably unnerved by the lack of movement. They call out to their friends, but hear nothing in return. They move a bit more, now very cautiously. Perhaps they notice expended cartridges on the ground or freshly broken window glass. All three stop cold, turn to each other, then sprint back toward their vehicles. Instantly, a young intelligence analyst reaches for the secure phone on her desk. She is 23 years old and on her second combat tour. No one is directing her actions, and no one would reprimand her if she did nothing. But she knows what to look for, and she has just seen it. She is aware of this particular compound's importance in the current fight, as she is in seamless contact with the intelligence team supporting nighttime operations. Most important, she knows exactly whom to contact. Her phone call is not being made to inform, and is not a request for permission. Its purpose is to create action, which is exactly what it does. There's movement at last night's compound. Vehicle arrived, three people exited, then hopped back in the vehicle and sped east after realizing there'd been a fight, she says to the operator on the other end of the line. Get it on, he yells to his operators, who instantly reach for their gear. 60 seconds have passed since the vehicle sped away. Okay, we're looking at it, he says, back on the line. He has now pulled up the same intelligence video feed in his operations room. He puts her on speakerphone so that her voice can help feed the thinking of the personnel in his team room. She explains what she's seen while he and the others on his team listen. They watch the vehicle's movement as the operations center goes from medium to full octane in a matter of 60 seconds. Likely vehicle routes are mapped on displays at the front of the operations center. Helicopter engines start to whir,